This is The Guardian. I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story. In this episode, you're going to hear from Roya, and her story is one you don't often get to hear.
When a woman leaves, when she soars the echoes of her once-upon-a-time relationship, someplace silent and still, someplace out of the mind's eye, she has the space to see herself again, for the first time in a long time, the space to sit in the quiet.
Roya grew up in Afghanistan and then Pakistan. When she came to Australia, she was just 14 and in an arranged marriage. Her husband, an older, controlling man. In collaboration with a new podcast called Tender, Roya tells her story in her own words, detailing what happened when she left her abusive relationship after a particularly violent attack by her husband in the summer of 1998. In this episode, there are some heavy moments, but also some uplifting ones. But if stories about sexual and physical abuse are triggering for you, be gentle with yourself, and we will list some support services at the end. Roya's story begins in hospital.
Hospitals are a disarray of noise and distress. Newborns cry and whimper, as do their tired mothers. Men pace hallways, jittery and cradling hot cheap coffee, courtesy of one jerry-built cafe on the ground level. Visitors curse parking fees, the weather, the restless children, their restless roommates. Alarm sounds regularly and with urgency. It was December, sticky and unforgiving with its heat, and it certainly wasn't the first time I had been admitted. By the time I had found myself in a Perth hospital's burns unit, I had already given birth to four beautiful children. I had already tackled labor and all that comes with it. But it was different now. Things were different now. Hospitals are placed riddled with angst and desperation. Time stands still. Faces merge into each other, and aging flowers and tired bodies ebb and flow out of sterile rooms. I don't remember all of the names of the nurses who tended to me, who waited for my singed body to adjust to shower temperature, room temperature, bed temperature. But I do remember this. My time in the burn unit was transformative, important. It was a safe haven, a singular, solid place I could just be in. Sometimes in the night, I'd wake to nightmare of my husband, and a nurse would run in only to recite calming affirmations, patting my head, saying things like, "Roya, you're in hospital. You're safe. You're okay." People cared, and I noticed. It was that simple. I was alive. What does it mean for a space to become yours? Like really, truly become yours? What does it look like? Does it look like jangly earrings on an enthusiastic nurse getting into Christmas cheer? Does it look like the way a woman from the Muslim Women's Support Center, a compassionate, kind, and gentle woman, pasted Eid Mubarak posters around my bed to celebrate the end of Ramadan? Was it love in the shape of festive decoration, of trusting my story? What happens when we are given permission to howl, to be mad and sad and wounded? What happens when good-natured nurses hold our hand while changing our bandages, only to say,
"It's okay if you want to cry and scream. It's okay."
What happens when you venture into the real world of TAFE classrooms, of parenthood, of late-night dancing brazenly to Bollywood classics with hard-earned new friends, of standing up in front of your religious community and declaring your truth, of reminding other women of what they do and don't deserve? What happens after the court orders and the phone calls, the self-doubt and frustration, the grief and the growth?
I received a telephone call early one morning from an agency that I frequently worked alongside with information that a young woman was in hospital with serious burns, believed to have possibly been caused by a family member. I made inquiries with the hospital and later met Roya for the first time. With a small staff, I was a sergeant in charge of the family unit within Western Australia Police and had the primary role to inform and guide police officers in matters of family and domestic violence.
That's Carol, who worked tirelessly in Western Australian Police Force, who handled my case and who later became my friend.
At the time, a government review of restraining orders was being undertaken and strategies to improve the response to complaints of family violence by the various involved agencies were being implemented.
When I moved to Perth from Pakistan, I was 14 years old, a child in every sense of the word. My teenage years were not reckless or formative, like many an adolescent's. Instead, they were restrictive and isolating. I was not permitted to make friends or immerse myself in this new foreign country. I stayed quiet and restrained in my husband's home, a home I shared with his family, tending to my domestic duties. Because of this, meeting people like Carol, people invested in my case and my recovery, was my first foray into friendship. Despite how much my burns throbbed, ached and stung, my world was changing for the better around me. And for the first time, I could see some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. I was ready.
Roya is very special and I'm extremely proud of her achievements and of the beautiful woman she is and how much she continues to give to others.
Despite being such a widespread global epidemic, domestic violence is an isolating experience. It somehow manages to convince survivors like me that they are alone, that hope and support and closure are just pipe dreams, and that even if it's out there, justice I mean, not often do we feel we deserve it, or that's ours to acquire. That's why talking about domestic violence like this is so important, and I am not just referring to grisly details of abuse, of court dates or meetings with police officers, but also what happens afterwards. I feel it's my responsibility to talk about my experiences. It is my power. With my word, I hope to give other women the confidence to use their own.
There is a hidden crime wave in this country. It's killing an Australian woman every week and leaving the many survivors with the most horrible physical and psychological scars. Domestic violence is the crime hiding in the shadows of suburbia, in our towns and cities. A crime shrouded in shame and secrecy.
When a thing goes up in flames, it becomes larger than itself. Have you ever seen a building as it sways a light? It swells. It's some kind of ominous, fiery silhouette. A single tree can quickly turn into a blackened forest, and a match can create blazing ripples that attach themselves to whatever fabric they can find in their path. That's the thing about fire. It moves and it travels. When my husband invited something red and ablaze into our home, he didn't realize he had summoned something larger than himself. There is something burning, still. This I can admit, but it is within me now. And I use this power, this heat, to assist other women, to help them locate the strength I found during my time in the burns unit, the driving force I had to leave. One thing that shifted in my hospital stay was my relationship to the word no. I could say it. Finally. If a nurse was too rough or invasive or required something of me I wasn't willing to give at that given time, I was safe enough to refuse. It was my decision to decide what was and wasn't done to my body. I learned not to fear the repercussion of it, of what it meant to create boundaries, to assert space. With every no came more and more strength. With every no came control. And so when I received a phone call from an uncle, apparently, when a nurse entered my room to tell me that there was a call waiting.
Roya, there's a phone call for you from your uncle. Would you like to take it?
Somebody on the line who insisted he was a relative. I knew to trust my gut. There was no uncle waiting for me on that line. Only him, my husband. When this man held a match to my body, his readiness to douse me in hate, in his hate, in his prejudice, in his cruelty, only then to watch me burn as I held our child, was enough. I didn't owe him my warmth. I never did. I tell you what he said, but I can't. I didn't take the call. I said no.
Next, finding a voice after violence.
I'm just going to close the door as well, just in case. Yep, definitely. Sounds good.
So, Roya, after being set alight by your husband, you woke up in hospital, and it sounds like this was a turning point for you and you decided to leave. What was your experience like trying to access services to support you and your kids in the aftermath of this incredibly traumatic event?
When I first leave my ex-husband, my experience was like, I guess accessing services was quite limited, and mainly because I was not aware that there was any services.
How did you feel reaching out to these support services or about the idea of reaching out for help in general?
It was really, really traumatic, and it was really scary because first, you don't know what they're doing. Second, you don't know who they're going to talk to. And like, you know, with the privacy and like confidentiality, and especially with family domestic violence, because there's like so much judgment and there's like such a taboo subject. So it's not the easiest thing that one can do.
What was your fear in reaching out? What was kind of that narrative that you were hearing?
First of all, my fear was like that nobody would help me and say, well, that's not our problem. Second, that I didn't know what they could help me. And third, obviously, of being judged, because I was like quite young, you know, mother of four children coming from a different background and escaping FDV, thinking that I was the only one actually that, you know, was a victim of family and domestic violence, that people would think it's my fault, that I stayed with him, that I made this happen, that I let it happen. So there was a lot to be, you know, scared of.
Mm.
I have always said it personally, it was those first meetings, the first people that I've met that actually shaped out how I tried to get out of my abusive relationship. It had not explained the system for me, I probably would not have been able to leave him. I probably would have gone back to him, and I don't know what would have happened. But I think because of the lack of awareness with the family and domestic violence to begin with, so the whole support that was provided to me or was aimed was on that single incident that happened on that night, that when my ex-husband tried to kill me. I lived with him for 6 years, and there was like abuse from every aspect of our life. But somehow everything was only focused on that single incident.
Despite not knowing much about the justice system, you did press charges, and your former husband was convicted of grievous bodily harm and sentenced to 12 years in jail. But did you feel that there were particular gaps in the system for migrant women like yourself and for their families?
There definitely was. It was really hard not knowing, you know, what support services were available. There also was big lack of support services for me and for my children compared to what's available now, especially for someone like me who was relatively new to Australia. They weren't really equipped to support me in ways I needed to be supported. For example, I had never paid utility bills or rent before in my life, and I had no idea, like, you know, how to go about it. Like, I was never aware of, and nobody told me, like, you know, that I can get support with housing. Nothing, no help with, like, childcare. I had no help with, like, enrolling them in school, getting them to school, like, no financial support in anything aside from Centrelink. There was like no housing support. Like, I had to fend for myself and look for rentals, literally like sleeping in people's, like, you know, bedrooms until I found a place to stay. And the biggest thing that, looking back, was the simplest thing, counseling and trying to deal with my trauma and supporting me in being ready, like, to deal with the system, going to court, giving evidence, going to the police. So my children, they obviously couldn't speak English because they were young. But the fact that they didn't get any counseling, they literally saw everything that happened to me. I know they had one visit with a counselor that came and spoke to them, and then it was left at that. As soon as like the court was finished, even though like the police, you know, like they were still in contact with me, but the support in a sense, it finished the day that the court finished. I had to fend for myself.
So Rhea, you had never really interacted with the outside world, with broader Australian society up to this point, and then you're suddenly thrust into it. What did you find?
I was like this person that nobody wanted to be around. People used to see me with this, like, you know, this foreign woman that I used to wear the scarf and dress differently, and my English wasn't really well. And especially with the scars, they would see the burn scars and they would always like be, oh, you know, they either thought that it was, I was okay with what had happened to me, or they would not even dare ask just in case they offended me in somehow.
There's being different, sure. But there's being made aware of your difference at every turn, having it to inform your every decision. And I wasn't just a Muslim woman. I was a Muslim woman who had been assaulted by her Muslim partner in a period of time where Islam was feared in the West and branded a kind of creed that depended upon violence, upon terror, upon destruction. As David Chariot Madri writes for The Guardian, Islam can be a convenient focus for the rage we feel after hearing about acts of brutality. But don't mistake something being seductive for it being accurate. Existing in the world as a Muslim woman who has been abused made for a tempting narrative for those unwilling to learn or understand my faith. Despite not having my husband dress me anymore, my expression of self was inevitably being tainted by other oppressive force, racial prejudice.
I am sitting patiently as men and women in blue gather in a small room, noticing tiny but discernible gestures of camaraderies amongst and between them. A smile, a tap, a nod. They're like one another, each in their matching ensemble, or at least they look similar. They're excited too, fresh-faced and ready to join the Australian police force, wanting only one thing, to catch the bad guys.
But to understand the villain, the hooded lawbreaker, the enemy of the state, the police needed to ask around, to speak to, or at least observe, somebody who understands intimately what it means to fear for their own life in the way that I did.
Their curiosity was laced with questions and concerns. Why weren't they summoned earlier? What was I scared of, exactly? How could they have stopped it?
You're probably wondering how I got here.
Surrounded by newly enlisted police officers as they each eagerly wait for me to address them, to speak to them head-on about the state of domestic violence in this country, to offer them insight and perhaps even some kind of consolation that they're doing enough, or at least that what is enough isn't too far out of reach. Carol, the police officer who tended to my case, had invited me to talk directly to my experience,
under the guise that that alone, my sheer existence, was able to offer a kind of expertise to those on the front line. Something important. In many ways, the gesture itself of standing before the force in a training room at the police academy suggested that I had all the answers, that they were embedded in my recollection of the events that took place.
My understanding that my after was informative, was sufficient, was enough, or rather was resolved.
So Roya, just 2 years after you were admitted to hospital for severe burns, you started speaking regularly to roomfuls of police officers about your experience as a victim survivor. What types of questions did they ask you, and what types of questions do lots of people generally ask you?
It's always about, why didn't I leave? Why didn't I tell anybody, you know, about what was happening to me and to my children? Which is like the most frustrating question of all time. And aside from that, I think the other thing with me personally was a lot of them thought that it was like a part of my religion or my culture that would have made me be okay with being abused. And when they would actually find out that in my religion, man and woman have equal rights, it was quite surprising for them. And there were like so many times that they actually wanted proof. I remember in one of the training that I was talking about this, I got an email like that afternoon when I come back home from the trainer, and she was saying, oh, you know, there's like quite a few cadets, they just want to know where in the Quran, like where does it say that men and women are equal? Mm. And I can understand that, you know, they wanted proof that what I was saying was the truth.
Did you send them the page from the Quran? That
absolutely, I hadn't memorized because I knew that's something that they were like, and that was, believe it or not, that was not the only time. Mm. You know, like throughout the training that I did, there was been quite numerous time that people would have asked, this is not in our religion, you know, that it doesn't say just because you're a Muslim, your husband can bash you up.
So Roya, since then, you've continued your advocacy, including working on the ground with women who are just fleeing family and domestic violence. What is that like, seeing women begin to go through the same process that you did about 20 years ago?
So I basically see them when they come bloody and bruised from a hospital, you know, room in a hospital gown to a refuge, to where they are ready to move into their own house and have their safe place to go to. You know, I see the journey in their life, you know, that fear, the tears, the scared that when they first come in, and then that slowly disappears. And by the time they kind of like ready to house, you can see them smile. And honestly, that's the biggest privilege. That's something that keeps me going every time.
Do you see the same barriers pop up with these women, though, that you went through? What types of struggles are these women having in terms of accessing support?
There's a lot of barriers still. There are a lot of services out there, but not nearly enough. But the one thing that kind of like makes it a little bit harder for women that come from different background is like there's language barrier. They are different culture, different religion. Then there's like, you know, because of who they are and where they come from, it's just not about them and their children. It's about like the entire family. It's not something that they can just come to the refuge and they have somewhere safe to stay and that'll be the end of it. There's like a lot of different consequences when they ask for help. And a lot of the time it's like because they don't know, the same as me. Like a lot of the clients, I think, that come to the refuge, first, they don't know what Centrelink is or what Medicare is. Second, they don't know that they can actually go there and apply for Centrelink and will be able to get some support, or that they can get, like, you know, support with housing. And these things are all the stuff that kind of like makes it that much extra hard for them. And I guess being from a different background and not being able to understand, like, as I said, the language, I think that's one of the biggest problems. Mm. Going through my experience, I saw firsthand the gaps that there were in the system, the myths about family domestic violence, especially about people that come from different backgrounds, different cultures, different religion. Like half of me is like, of when I hear what they go through, like I am glad because I know that I can help them. I know that they're like help available as opposed to when it was happening to me. But the other half of me is like, I'm quite frustrated and angry that after everything that it still happens, that like in today's world, that women and children still suffer and they shouldn't.
So Roya, you've been involved in this podcast series, Tender, that's been charting your journey as you navigate life after abuse and what it means to live with abuse for a long time now. And I imagine the reality is that this can take a really long time and that the impacts can be felt in really different, nuanced and changing ways over years. So I'm wondering what advice or message you have for women or give women who are just starting on that journey.
I think one of the first thing that I like every person that is gone or experienced, like, you know, family domestic violence, to know very clearly, it is that it's not their fault. No matter how you feel at that time, it's not your fault. They have not caused it. It's a choice that somebody else has made. And to not lose hope, no matter how hard the day gets, there's always a tomorrow. And tomorrow can be better. There is help available. Don't be afraid or ashamed or scared to ask for help. That's what the services are there. It's there for people like you and me to ask for help and for them to support us. I have been through it and I've come out of it and I'm in a great place right now. And I know we all can do it. I guess the most important thing is you're not going to be stuck where you are today forever. Things can always change and can get better.
In Australia, the National Family Violence Counselling Service is on 1800 737 732. We've linked to the support services on the Full Story page as well. Thanks so much to Roya Atmar for her time. If you want to hear more of her story, do go and check out the podcast Tender, where her journey is chronicled in depth and in such a beautiful way across the six-part season. You can find it by searching for Tender wherever you get your podcasts. Season 2 of Tender is created by Madison Griffiths, Beth Atkinson-Quinton and Roya Atmar, with Shakira Hussein, Danae Gibson and John Chia. This collaboration between Tender and Full Story was produced by Beth Atkinson-Quinton, Melanie Tate, Ellen Lee Beater and Joe Koning, who also did the sound design. The executive producers of Full Story are Gabrielle Jackson, Melanie Tate and me, Laura Mifiotes. Okay, catch you tomorrow.